From WBUR in Boston, I'm Doug Tribou, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. The Deflategate saga shows no sign of losing air. Ahead on Only a Game, the lessons all employees can learn from the battle between Tom Brady and the NFL. Also, we'll learn why one group is claiming an NFL program to encourage kids to exercise is a bad idea, and how an Indian sprinter has the world asking questions about gender and sports. Plus, I sit down with the first Japanese major leaguer, Masanori Murakami. Also ahead, boxer Daniel Jacobs recalls his toughest bout.
I'm not talking about battles in the ring. I'm talking about my biggest battle that I've had in my life, which is fighting cancer. Just made it all the sweeter once they raised my hand and said, "You are the new middleweight champion of the world."
Stay tuned. The air isn't quite out of the Deflategate balloon yet. On Tuesday, the NFL upheld New England quarterback Tom Brady's four-game suspension. That sets the stage for a legal battle in federal court. Brady hasn't set foot inside a courtroom, but some would say we already know about the situation in excruciating detail, right down to the NFL's claim that Brady had an assistant destroy his cell phone that potentially contained evidence of wrongdoing. But how would all of this be playing out if Tom Brady wasn't Tom Brady and the NFL wasn't the NFL? Joining me is Lewis Maltby, the author of Can They Do That? Retaking Our Fundamental Rights in the Workplace. Lewis, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Let's imagine Tom Brady's an average guy. Say he delivers pizzas. Brady's bosses want the pies delivered piping hot. He likes them a little cooler. They think there's evidence on his cell phone. Can they demand that he hand it over?
If Tom Brady was delivering pizzas, his boss would call him in his office, say, "Brady, you're fired, clean out your office and leave," and that would be the end of it.
But he's great at it. I mean, what if they really want to retain his services?
One of the few legal rights that Brady would have if he delivered his pizzas is a right to privacy. And some judges might say that making somebody give up their personal cell phone is a violation of the right to privacy. But not in this context. If you were suspected of workplace misconduct and your boss said, "Hand over the cell phone, we want to check this out," you're toast. You'll get fired and you're not going to get a day in court. You're just going to be out.
What if fictional Brady replaces his cell phone and he claims, as the real Brady has, that he did it after thinking it was no longer needed? Could he still get in trouble?
Doug, the problem here is that the rules for people like Brady and the rules for the rest of us are totally different. Brady's got a collective bargaining agreement. He's got a contract. The rest of us don't have that kind of contract. Your boss can fire you any time for any reason under the sun or no reason at all, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Lewis, Tom Brady wrote on his Facebook page that he's disappointed with the NFL's decision to uphold the suspension, not surprisingly, and that Commissioner Roger Goodell needs to respect his, quote, rights as a private citizen. Is that a fair claim?
No, it's not. The only text Goodell wanted to see were the texts that Brady may have sent to the two people who actually deflated the balls. Goodell's got every right to see those texts.
One thing I keep thinking about is how publicly this all plays out. And it's not leaks from the league. It's official statements and reports. And I just wonder if non-celebrities in less high-profile jobs can expect more privacy if they get into a situation with their employer.
Well, that's one place in which the rest of us are better off than Tom Brady. If your boss or my boss decides to fire us, we're just going to be out on our butts. But they're not going to tell the world about it.
The Players Association has filed suit in federal court on behalf of Tom Brady. The NFL has filed its own suit asking for a certification of the suspension. Who do you think is going to come out on top here?
It's not clear. What this court fight is all about is very narrow. It's not about whether Brady's innocent or guilty or whether he should be punished or how much. It's about who's got jurisdiction over this. Did Goodell have the right to make this decision himself, or did he have to have the case go to arbitration under the union contract?
As you look at the Tom Brady case, is there anything that a regular employee who's not in the headlines could take away from this a learning lesson?
The only lesson I can think of is join a union. It's not really being famous that's giving him some protection. It's the fact that he's got a contract. The rest of us, you know, we're just roadkill if the boss wants to hear it of us.
Lewis Maltby is the director of the National Work Rights Institute. Lewis, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
This week, Boston's dreams of Olympic glory died. The Boston 2024 bid was pulled after failing to win popular support in Massachusetts. That news turned eyes to Los Angeles, Toronto, and other North American cities as possible host sites. And that brings us to the first story in Only a Game's weekly look at the sports news you might have missed, three stories you should know. My guests are Jeremy Markovich, a senior writer at Our State magazine in North Carolina and a contributor to SB Nation long form. Jeremy, welcome back.
Hey.
And also joining us is longtime sports writer Rachel Bachman, who now covers health and fitness for The Wall Street Journal. Rachel, thanks for coming on again, and please start us off with your story.
Sure. Well, since Boston pulled out of the bidding for the 2024 Summer Olympics, a great idea has resurfaced, and that is to make a permanent site for the Summer Olympic Games. The best option on the table, I believe, is Greece. Here's a country that has its own deep economic problems. It could certainly use a stimulus. Greece presents a fantastic opportunity to have a permanent site that is known. It was, of course, the site of the original Olympic Games and is tested. The 2004 Summer Games were there. They could kill two birds with one stone.
Jeremy, do you like the idea of Greece being the permanent home of the Summer Olympics?
I do. I think it's an interesting idea, and of course you would save money by doing this. Although, on the flip side, as a viewer, as somebody who enjoys watching the Olympics and tuning in, I wonder if it loses a little bit of that cachet by being in the same place, because part of it seems to be that you are exposed to new cities, that you get to sort of see other interesting spots.
I think the final question is, what about the Winter Games? We just learned that Beijing is going to be hosting the Games in 2022. Other countries dropped out because of finances. I don't know if there's as natural a place for discussion with the Winter Games as there is with Greece for the Summer Games.
Well, that's a great point. And in fact, I think the most natural places are also the ones that seem the most reluctant to hold multiple games. Denver, for instance, is a fantastic site, I think, but has pulled out before of bidding. And Lillehammer. I think that the Winter Games are going to be increasingly difficult to site because also of global climate change.
Okay, Jeremy, you're up. Give us your story for this week.
So, you know, most of us, if you're like me, peaked in sports in high school and then really just kind of dropped off the cliff after that. In Finland, that is not so much the case. 90% of men and women there play sports two times a week. Now, this just didn't happen. In the 1970s, the government started subsidizing big and small gyms and big and small towns. Employers now get a tax break on gym vouchers for their workers or even workout facilities. The Finnish government thinks they save about $5.5 billion each year on healthcare. And my wonder is, could we do this in the United States? Is this something that we could pull off here in this country?
Rachel, let's turn it to you. You're the health and fitness reporter for the Wall Street Journal. How do you think something like that would work in the U.S.?
Well, it's funny. We sort of did used to have a national program for health and fitness. It was the company softball team. And yet we've seen that decline, as I've written about, to about only about 12% of companies now, I believe, offer any kind of team associated with the company. The companies have shown that they are less inclined than ever to support endeavors like this. And so you really need to get government support. And I think that's going to be a very tough sell with a lot of competition.
This is something we've covered on Only a Game before. We spoke to Ralph Nader and author Ken Reed about it. And I think that their point was, when the government gets involved, there's more likely to be this sort of widespread, even approach. But it does seem like there's a lot of government dollars spent on opportunities for people to get fit. There are parks and baseball fields and basketball courts built. I wonder if we're just not making use of the opportunities that we already have.
I think that's a great point. In fact, I've seen some data, I believe it's from the American College of Sports Medicine, that shows that there isn't necessarily a correlation between increase in parkland acreage and physical activity. It's a very tough problem to solve when you see the numbers of people who are still inactive despite even access to, you know, $10 a month gyms.
it really goes back to the old economic argument that people will respond to incentives. Even in Finland, though, those subsidies are starting to be cut in Finland, and there's a little bit of a worry that what's going to happen to something that has become such a part of the national identity if the subsidies start going away.
Okay, my story for this week involves baseball and computers. The San Rafael Pacifics, that's an independent minor league team in California, hosted the first professional baseball game in which a computer called the balls and strikes. It's the same kind of technology you see on TV where they have the strike zone up and show where the pitches land. And an announcer called out the results. And I've reported on this technology before. There's no question that it would be more consistent and more accurate, but I'm torn. Think about some of the great umps from history. Ron Luciano, Eric Gregg, Ken Kaiser. Their personalities, their arguments with managers, that was part of the fabric of the game. I just think maybe we're losing something, but maybe accuracy is worth it. Jeremy, why don't we start with you?
You know, there's also a lot of terrible umpires through history that people really don't like and just can't stand. But I'm kind of on the side of I'd like to see an umpire still calling balls and strikes. If for no other reason that baseball, for better or for worse, has sort of become a bit robotic, that there are statistics on statistics on statistics that teach you who to put in what situation, and you know, you can pop into a computer with some accuracy and figure out how many games you're going to win with the guys that are on the field. You have to figure out where the strike zone is as a batter or as a pitcher, because different umpires call the strike zone in different ways. That some are bigger, some are smaller, some are, you know, they're all different kinds of strike zones. I still like the idea that this adds what I think is still a human element into baseball. Balls and strikes, leave those alone.
Rachel, big blue behind the plate or a guy in a big blue shirt?
I'm going to take the contrarian's point of view and say, let's go with the robots. This is, of course, not probably the popular romantic position to take. But, you know, we've seen in pro tennis, line calls improve and sort of the overall accuracy improve with the instant replay Hawkeye system. You know, we can't forget that there are people whose livelihoods are riding on the correct calls. And now I should point out that in tennis's system, these calls are not made automatically on every play. Players just get a certain number of challenges and they can call the robot into play, so to speak. But I still think the overall gains in accuracy are worth sort of the loss of the human element and the great, you know, Bugs Bunny cartoon referees and umpires that we all love to make fun of and kick dirt at.
My guests for three stories you should know have been Jeremy Markovich, a senior writer at Our State magazine in North Carolina and a contributor to SB Nation long form, and Rachel Bachman, who covers health and fitness for The Wall Street Journal. Jeremy and Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Indian sprinter Dooty Chand got a victory this week, not on the track, but in court. Chand was banned last year from competing against other women. Track's international governing body said her natural testosterone levels were too high. Instead of undergoing surgery or taking hormone-suppressing drugs, Chand fought the decision, and on Monday, sport's highest international court ruled in her favor. Juliette McCourt has been following the story for The New York Times. Juliette, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks.
We've spoken to you about Dooty Chand before, but remind our listeners about her case.
Well, she naturally has high testosterone, so she was born like this. It wasn't the IAAF at that point. That's the track and field governing body. It was India Sports Authority. They had decided they were going to test her because some competitors said that she should not be competing with women because she was basically a man.
And you'd said to us when we spoke last fall that you were glad it wasn't up to you to decide, and you've even written that you pity the IAAF. Tell us why you feel that way.
It's not a cut and dry case at all, and it's very complicated. You know, you can argue both ways. I had a joke with my colleagues the other day. I said, well, this is an interesting sort of ending to this case, that they basically didn't rule definitively either way. The court, of course, said that she's able to compete at least for the next 2 years. And they said, well, come back to us in 2 years, and maybe by then there will be a whole different slate of arbitrators who have to look at this case again, because it's just so complicated and so much science and so many other nuanced issues that it's very difficult to make a decision that everybody will be happy with.
Right. And so what you're referencing is this ruling that gives the IAAF a couple of years to present new evidence that Chand's elevated testosterone provides an advantage. How likely are they to come up with evidence to support that claim?
The people I've talked to, the experts who have followed this issue, say that's very unlikely. Not because women with high levels of testosterone don't have a marked advantage, but it's sort of unprovable, or it might be completely unprovable, because there's so many other factors that go into success on the athletic field. The trainers you have, what you eat, how much you sleep, you know, your training facility. I mean, there's so many other things that are variables. It'll be hard to pinpoint high testosterone equals, you know, a 10 to 12% advantage, or whatever the Court of Arbitration for Sport is asking the IAAF to find. So it's, they asked a question that might not be able to be answered.
You spoke to a medical geneticist who said he was happy that Chand won her case, but is worried about the future of women in sports. Why is that?
He's basically saying that he's worried that the basis of competing in a woman's category will be a woman coming up to the starting line and saying, I am a woman, so I can compete. And he's saying that that is not enough. There has to be a line drawn somewhere. And he basically said that this doesn't really clear up anything. It does help Dutee Chand over the next couple of years. But in the grand scheme of things, the International Olympic Committee and the Olympic movement have been looking at this issue for decades. And nothing really looks like it's ever going to be resolved. It might be an unsolvable problem.
Some research has shown that hyperandrogenism is found in about 7 out of every 1,000 elite female track athletes. Do you think, looking ahead to the future, that this is enough to trigger some sort of significant change in how gender is viewed in these international sports competitions?
That is a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it might seem like not that many, but the 7 in 1,000 is actually 140 times the regular population. So that means that there's overrepresentation of athletes with hyperandrogenism in track and field.
Juliette McCurr is a columnist for The New York Times. You can link to her story, The Line Between Male and Female Athletes Remains Blurred, at onlyagame.org. Juliette, thanks.
You're welcome.
Preparing for a nationally televised boxing match can be a grind. Fighters are shuttled between workouts, weigh-ins, press conferences, and promotional appearances. But for boxer Daniel Jacobs, it's all a joy. We talked to Jacobs earlier this week as he prepared for his defense of his middleweight world title, and he told us why it's all worth it, in his own words.
The sport of boxing has been very important to my life because it simply taught me how to be a man. Obviously, growing up in Brownsville, Brooklyn was one of the toughest neighborhoods that you can possibly grow up in. Kids resort to other things, and that's taking it to the streets and taking it to a whole nother level. And I didn't want to resort to that, so I approach everything like I approach the sport of boxing. You have to train mentally, physically to get ready for the task at hand. And, you know, if you're best equipped, more times out of none, you'll be successful. The day I won my title was a very special day because it was a moment that I was looking for a very long time since I started my journey in boxing. And with all the battles that I've had, just made it all the sweeter once they raised my hand and said, you are the new middleweight champion of the world. I'm not talking about battles in the ring. I'm talking about my biggest battle that I've had in my life, which is the battle of fighting cancer. When I first realized there might be something wrong with me, I was in Iraq, and I was on a USO tour visiting the troops and showing them how to box and doing little exhibitions with them. And then I started to realize that I had some tingling in my legs and a little weakness. Then when I got home from my trip, I realized that I had to start walking with a cane. So I went to the doctor, and at first they misdiagnosed me and told me that I had a pinched nerve. Obviously, the pinched nerve turned out to be something far worse than we could imagine. It took about 3 weeks for me walking with a cane to me being completely immobile in a wheelchair, and then I had to get rushed to the hospital. And the issue was that I had a massive tumor wrapped around my spine. They said I had osteosarcoma, which is a very rare bone cancer. The whole battle was just devastating. Not worried about boxing, not worried about anything other than making sure I can be here for my son. The doctors told me that boxing would be out the question, that, you know, I would never have a career again in the sport of boxing. It would serve me best to stay out of the gym and to just disregard boxing as a whole. all I wanted to do was the things that I hated doing as far as training goes. Like, I never really liked to get up in the morning and run. My trainers would have to, you know, call me and force me to do certain things. So I remember laying in the hospital bed just always wishing that I could do those certain things. I was locked away. I was caged away. I felt like I was in jail. And, you know, I didn't want to listen to anybody. I just wanted to follow my dreams. And if I was going to have a chance at getting better, you know, I was going to take it into my own hands. And it was going to start with me going to the boxing gym. My second day outside of the recovery hospital, I went to the gym. Even though I had a back brace on, I still was walking with a cane. But I was in the gym, and I was throwing my little 1-2 punches on the bag. So that would be my therapy opposed to going to their physical therapy. This time around is different, you know. I'm calling my trainers and asking them, where are they while I'm running in the morning? And, you know, I'm ahead of the game, you know. And that's all because it was stripped away. You know, anytime you cherish something and it's taken away, you know, when it comes back around for a second time, you're definitely going to have more of appreciation for it. My two boxing names then was the Golden Child. And the Golden Child represents just a very talented, young, up-and-coming prospect. Still a kid in his mind. And my nickname now is the Miracle Man. The nickname Miracle Man represents me having a miracle happen, which is becoming not only a champion, but the first cancer survivor to ever be a world champion. God puts you through certain tests and challenges, and, you know, with the faith that I had and the battle that I was going through, it changed me as a man. I'm a better father, you know, I'm a better friend, I'm a better student, I'm a better boyfriend, I'm a better man all in general. So God has had his hands on me. You know, I never thought I'd wake up and just appreciate the sun beaming into the window, or walking out and, you know, seeing the grass and the trees and just nature, or even older couples holding hands. Like, I just appreciate everything about life. Cancer has not been something that has been bad for me. It's been more like a blessing in disguise.
Daniel Jacobs' title defense is part of the Premier Boxing Champions Series, which is shown on ESPN and other networks. Our story on Jacobs was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. Japan's love affair with baseball began sometime around 1870. The nation would develop its own high school, college, and pro leagues, but it would take nearly 100 years before Japan would export a player to Major League Baseball in the United States. Masanori Murakami's story is the subject of the new book Mashi by Robert Fitz, and Masanori Murakami, Robert Fitz, and translator Eureka Romer join me in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Hi, Doug.
Konnichiwa.
Mashi, you made your major league debut with the San Francisco Giants on September 1st, 1964 at Shea Stadium in New York against the Mets. It was the eighth inning. What do you remember about that moment?
Giants behind 4-0. When I play in the minor leagues, people come to the ballpark with maybe 400 and 500. September 1st is Shea Stadium's 40,000 people announce, now pitching San Francisco Giants, number 10, Masanori Murakami.
Did the crowd give you a loud ovation as you went into the stadium?
Yes, like that, you know. But I don't understand, you know.
The fans at Shea were famous for heckling opposing players. And to everybody's surprise, they stood up and cheered. And when I sat down to write this book, I thought one of the themes would be the difficulties of playing in America so soon after World War II, having to adapt to maybe a hostile environment and talking to players, talking to fans, talking to Mashi. That was not the case.
I'd like to have you describe how a miscommunication between the San Francisco Giants and the Nankai Hawks almost created something of an international incident.
Sure. When the arrangements were made for Mashi and two other minor leaguers to come from the Nankai Hawks to the San Francisco Giants, there was a 2-page agreement written up for the teams to sign, and it was in English. And when it was given to the Hawks, they didn't bother to have it translated. They had the go-between man, whose name was Cappy Harada, who could speak both languages, kind of summarize it orally to them. And they missed a couple important points. One was, legally, the Hawks had to release these Japanese players from their contracts. And the more important point that they missed was that the San Francisco Giants could hold on to any of these contracts, buy them outright for only $10,000. Well, after Bashi did so fabulously well in 1964, the San Francisco Giants said, all right, you know, we want them. So Bashi goes back in the New Year's of 1964/65 to spend time with his family, and he's given a hero's welcome at the airport. And in the middle of this wonderful press conference, the Nankai Hawks general manager stands up and says, oh, I'm sorry, he's not going back to the Giants. We own his rights. He's going to pitch in Japan. That led to a whole winter of fighting between the two teams until they made a compromise in May, and Bashi was able to come back for the Giants for another season.
Bashi, were you glad to return to the Giants in 1965?
I'm very happy, yes. But only practice. I never pitched a game over there.
During this contract dispute, he was allowed to practice only and not pitch in games. There was no spring training for him. It was, he arrived in San Francisco, and 3 days later, he's in a Major League Baseball game, having not thrown against a live batter for May through October the year before.
When the 1965 season ended, did you want to return to Japan, or did you want to continue?
Stay over here.
You wanted to stay over here?
Of course.
The reasons behind Bashi's return to Japan were too complicated for him to describe in English, so he turned to his translator for the day, filmmaker Eureka Rohmer, for help.
Originally, the Nankai Hawks manager, Tsuruoka-san, came to him, and there was a promise made that he would be sent to the United States to study baseball. The other side of that is that he had always promised Tsuruoka, the manager, that he would return to Japan, and so even though he wanted to stay in the United States, he basically felt it was a very strong obligation because his side of the bargain had been met, and so therefore he needed to meet the other side of the bargain.
After Masanori appears in 1964 and 65, we don't get another Japanese big leaguer until 1995. What happened?
Right. After Bashi returned to Japan, Major League Baseball and Japan Professional Baseball came up with an agreement that each side would respect the reserve clauses of the other country's contracts. Now, back then, there was no free agency. Players were tied to their teams until they retired or until they were traded. So, in effect, that agreement kept all Japanese players in Japan. Nomo found a loophole in these agreements.
And you're talking about Hideo Nomo, the first player after Bashi.
That's correct. He realized that the Japanese version of the player's contract was really only valid in Japan. And then very quickly, the Japanese realized, oh, that's a mistake. And they redid the player's agreement, and they've come up with the systems they have now.
Today, Japanese big leaguers are commonplace. Ichiro Suzuki, Yu Darvish. But do you think Masanori's place in the history of the game is hurt by that 30-year-long gap?
Well, yeah, I think so. At the time, people were writing articles saying, you will see the floodgates open up and Japanese coming. That didn't happen because of this agreement. But what he did do is, prior to Bashi coming over, American fans and even American baseball people looked down on Japanese baseball. They thought it was double-A standard. And then here you have a 20-year-old young man who only had pitched in the Japanese minor leagues, and he's become an effective, even star as a relief pitcher on a major league team in the middle of a pennant race. So it opened eyes at all levels, and it opened up the Japanese eyes that they were much better than they thought they were at the time.
Looking back now, are you happy with how your career turned out after you were in American baseball?
He has a pretty deep regret about his not being able to play for longer in the United States. He had a good baseball life, but he wishes that he could have played here more. That's probably the strongest sentiment that he holds. I mean, you know, obviously he feels that it was good that he came here. You know, now there's many players have come from Japan, and you know, he likes that. But the thing that he holds in his heart is he wishes that he could have been here for longer.
He said something when I interviewed him several years ago, and he didn't mean this to be a poem. He says, "There was a grand stage before me, and I was ready to take it. But I cannot actually go on. So many regrets." I think that sums it all up.
Robert Fitz is the author of Mashi, and he joined me in the studio. Robert, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Masanori Murakami was the first player from Japan to play in the major leagues. He spent 2 years pitching for San Francisco and another 18 years pitching in Japan. Masanori, thank you very much for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm Doug Tribou. Coming up on Only a Game, a paraplegic outdoorsman returns to the places he loves. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Doug.
I'm not sure if you heard the news, but this week the NFL upheld Tom Brady's 4-game suspension. Brady and the NFLPA have filed a suit, so has the NFL. In your role as Chief Justice of the Only a Game Kangaroo Court, how is all of this going to play out?
First of all, Tom Brady's been suspended? Did I miss the memo? You know, I am at this point planning on holding a Labor Day telethon to beg the nation to make this story go away. I think that there's probably a 60-40 chance that Brady loses his appeal or loses before the court. At this point, I so don't care about this story. This thing should have been settled in January with a $25,000 fine.
In your Grantland article earlier this week, you suggest that the Deflategate story has distracted from other league issues, which is exactly as the NFL wants it. How so?
Well, I just think the whole concussion protocol and the inexcusable silencing of Junior Seau's family at his Hall of Fame induction, and the fact that Kenny Stabler, who passed away, donated his brain and his spinal column to the Cognitive Study Center here at Boston University, that issue has sort of faded. So maybe it's not Deflategate as much as it is Deflectgate.
Charlie, are you ready to play a little Final Jeopardy?
Sure, why not?
Okay, the category is Major League Baseball trades. Answer: his trade on Monday night ruined an answer on Wednesday's broadcast of Jeopardy.
Who is or what is a Tulowitzki?
That's right. The answer was, in 2015, shortstop Troy Tulowitzki hopes to help this team fulfill its mile-high hopes that had been the Rockies. Tulowitzki was traded to Toronto Monday night, and the Blue Jays also traded for Detroit starting pitcher David Price. The Blue Jays are going all in a crowded playoff hunt. Good move.
Well, I mean, we've all been sitting here waiting for the Blue Jays to make the playoffs again for about 5 years now, and they've always cratered after the All-Star break. This indicates that they think they have a real shot. I think the Blue Jays and the Astros, as far as the trading deadline goes, are the two teams that are most obviously trying to win it this year.
This week, retired slugger Jose Canseco said he plans to take a week to show his support for Caitlyn Jenner. But is Caitlyn Jenner or anyone asking for the kind of support he's offering?
Jose Canseco is going to support Caitlyn Jenner by living as a woman for a week. Far be it from me to claim that this is perhaps a publicity stunt, but when he was asked what that means, he said, "Full everything."
On Monday, the USOC and Boston 2024 parted ways, so we will not see rhythmic gymnastics, synchronized swimming, or any other Olympic competition here in Boston in 2024. IOC President Thomas Bach said that Boston failed to deliver on promises. Which promises was he talking about?
To stick the taxpayers of the Commonwealth with whatever inevitable cost overruns occur by hosting the Olympics. This is the smartest thing Boston has done since we broke away from Great Britain.
Basketball Hall of Famer Nancy Lieberman will join the Sacramento Kings this season as an assistant coach. This is a trend in the NBA. Last season, San Antonio hired Becky Hammon. But now another sports league's following suit. Which one, and were you surprised?
Well, I like the fact that Nancy Lieberman is in the NBA because Nancy Lieberman is a thoroughgoing hoot. She's just a great person to be around. It's going to be a lot of fun following the Kings this year. Jen Welter, who played arena ball, which made her the first woman to play a fairly serious, which is to say televised, level of football, she's going to be an assistant coach with the Arizona Cardinals. And good for her, and good for Bruce Arians for hiring her.
Leland's will be auctioning off goalie Jim Craig's collection of Miracle on Ice hockey memorabilia. Craig hopes to net almost $6 million. Anything on the list catch your eye?
He's auctioning off the flag, which I'm not entirely sure is legal. But he, I mean, I have a problem with auction. I mean, unless you're in desperate financial straits, with auctioning off your gold medal. I just think that's something you would hang on to. He wants $5.7 million. Oddly enough, the most expensive hockey memorabilia to go at auction so far was Paul Henderson, who won the 1972 Summit Series against the Soviet Union for Canada. His jersey sold for almost $1.3 million. That was in 2010. I'm not entirely sure that Craig will get quite that much money, but boy, he's auctioning an awful lot.
And finally, Charlie, presidential hopeful Donald
I'm sorry. When you say that, I crack up. I'm sorry.
Presidential hopeful Donald Trump has been stumping all over the place lately, including at Scotland's Turnberry, where the Women's British Open is underway. Trump owns the course, but apparently he still received an invitation to be there.
Yeah, first of all, he's campaigning for votes in the vital Turnberry primary, which takes place after the Iowa caucuses. But no, he was, of course, because he is Donald Trump, of course, he was there because, quote, the world has asked me to be here. Well, you know what? I'll bet I can find a native tribe on a tiny island in Malaysia that didn't ask Donald Trump to go to the Women's British Open. I'll bet I can do that.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins Bill Littlefield each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Later this month, Crested Butte, Colorado will host the Off-Road Hand Cycling World Championships, where David Poole is expected to be among the top racers. But for Poole, hand cycling is about much more than competition. Danielle Thompson has our story.
3 months ago, I saw David Poole cycling for the first time, and I couldn't get him out of my head. He doesn't have use of his legs, so he was pedaling up a steep mountain with only his arms. Today, I'm joining David on that same trail, hiking behind him as he cranks up Mount Ellis. The climb is hard for David. I have no trouble keeping up on foot, even though I'm 7 months pregnant and he's pedaling furiously. To understand how we got here, you have to start in the small town where he grew up, Townsend, Montana.
It's 5 minutes from the river, it's 5 minutes from the lake, and it's 5 minutes from the mountain. We did a lot of camping, we did a lot of exploring in the mountains, we did a lot of fishing, and we did a lot of hunting.
David was always a hard charger in the outdoors, earning him the nickname Madman Poole as a teenager. That name and that mentality stuck. When he graduated from high school, he headed out on his next adventure, working at a ski resort in Colorado. One day, while skiing on his lunch break, David's life changed forever.
I got hung up on some rocks and tumbled down a big cliff. I woke up in the snow. My upper body was cold, and it seemed like my lower body was warm, but really I couldn't feel it at all. I remember a patroller yelling my name, asking if it was me, and I told them it was. And they had to carry me out on this stretcher, and as soon as I got in the helicopter, the guy said, "You made it." And he gave me the stuff to fall asleep and wake up in the ICU. My mom and my dad and my two best friends from Montana were in the hospital in Denver, and I asked them, "What are you guys doing here?" And they said, "Well, we heard you got in an accident." And I said, "Yeah, but it's Monday. Don't you guys have jobs?" And they're like, "Well, this is kind of serious."
David learned that he was paralyzed from the sternum down.
The thing that bummed me the most was I wasn't going to be able to hike in the mountains and hunt like I used to. Every time I saw a picture of an elk or I would think about hunting, it took a while to really get over that.
David sounds nonchalant, but his eyes are full of emotion. Relearning how to perform daily tasks like getting dressed and going to the bathroom didn't intimidate him. His greatest loss was his ability to get into wild places. After 3 months of physical therapy, he returned home to Townsend and went back to work running the family lawn mowing business. He resumed much of his normal life, with one major exception.
Every summer, I was stuck. I was trapped. My friends were able to go into the mountains and talk about how great a time they had.
They offered to pull David along on a game cart, which is basically a wheelbarrow for getting large animals out of the woods. You can imagine that didn't sound appealing to him. so he found something that could help him power himself into the backcountry. A new piece of gear called an off-road hand cycle. It looks like something out of a Mad Max movie. Super low to the ground, wide in front, skinny in the back. The rider leans forward with his chest over the pedals. These bikes aren't cheap. $7,000 for a new one. But 7 years after his accident, David was able to purchase the used one for much less. In typical madman pool fashion, he rode it every day, everywhere he could.
Going new places every day, pushing my limits every day, seeing where it can go, and loving every minute of it because I was experiencing some of the things that I never thought I'd be able to experience again.
But he still hadn't been in the backcountry. After he'd been riding for a few months, friends invited him on their annual camping trip to a remote mountain lake. The trail would be more challenging than anything he had ridden so far.
It starts off with 13 switchbacks dropping down a steep slope, and then an additional probably 2 or 3 miles of up and down with basketball-sized boulders and stumps to go over the entire way. The first 8 switchbacks were way too narrow for my bike. I had to have my buddies tie a rope up to me to keep me from tipping and rolling downhill while I'm angled on this really steep side hill. But after about 8 switchbacks, I was able to get the rest of them on my own. It took me 4.5 hours to get into the lake. It was awesome. Unexplainable. It was freedom. It was everything.
Back on the trail, David and I finish a slow and steady climb to a lookout point. He's crazy fast on the downhill, so he takes off ahead of me. In the distance, as he flies down, I hear happy shouts. For Only a Game, I'm Danielle Thompson in Bozeman, Montana.
NFL training camps are just getting underway after a tough year or so for the league's image. But teaching kids about exercise, would anyone criticize that? Well, it turns out they would. Since 2007, the NFL has been running a program that encourages kids to exercise for 60 minutes a day. This is what one of their events sounds like. In January, I attended this Play 60 Challenge at the Phoenix Convention Center a couple of days before the Super Bowl. On a full-sized football field, hundreds of kids wiggled, jumped, and ran in place while some NFL players and staff led the routines. We were on the second floor of the building, and I could feel it vibrating. I would have loved this when I was a kid. Anna Isaacson is the vice president of social responsibility for the NFL.
It's not really about playing football necessarily, but it's really about finding what moves you to be physically active. And so if it's bike riding, great. Girls and boys. And if it's football, even better.
The girls and boys in Phoenix were part of a contest that tracked how much they exercised. The NFL held it in schools. The teachers I spoke with were enthusiastic about it and said their students were too. The classes with the best participation rates won a trip to the pre-Super Bowl event.
Can I talk to you guys, ask you a few questions? Okay.
I interviewed almost 20 kids. A lot of them said that they'd done more running and push-ups because of the contest. Travion goes to Bernard Black Elementary School.
And Travion, what did you like about the Play 60 program?
That we get to play games and have fun.
Did you keep track of your 60 minutes while for a month?
Not really.
Not really? Were you getting exercise every day, you think?
Sometimes.
Yeah. What's your favorite way to exercise?
Oh, no.
Eunice from Dunbar Elementary enjoyed the event, including a handout from an NFL sponsor.
And what do you think about the exercise program? Did you enjoy doing it?
Yes. My most favorite part was mostly the Skittles. Everybody, I like that part.
Brian Fortune teaches fourth grade at Cactus Wren Elementary in Phoenix. Free candy notwithstanding, Fortune sees anything that gets his students moving as progress.
Most of our kids nowadays are just playing video games all day long. I mean, it's hard to pull them away to do homework and kind of motivate the kids. I had a kid who honestly couldn't fit into his shirt when he got his shirt today, and it was like, oh, man. I mean, they have to get outside and play, and even if it's just for 1 month, I mean, it's going to benefit all the kids.
Josh Golan disagrees.
I mean, if we're telling that kid that he should exercise because the NFL is encouraging him to do so, then we're also telling him that he should go to McDonald's when the NFL does an NFL Happy Meal promotion.
Golan is the executive director of the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood. Earlier this year, he co-authored a report titled Out of Bounds, the NFL's Intensive Campaign to Target Children. I spoke to him this week.
The NFL is hosting its websites for Play 60 in the same place where it's hosting all of its video games, where it's hosting its videos, its promotions for its telecasts. If kids are getting involved in Play 60, they may be exercising some, but if they really are into it, they're also getting a lot of sedentary screen time.
All sports leagues try to reach kids, but with concussions and other injury risks in the news, the NFL risks losing young players and fans to other sports. Golan believes that's one reason the NFL is going further than the other leagues by using what marketers call a 360-degree approach.
Online gaming, they're using television, partnerships with nonprofit organizations like the American Heart Association. They're using live events, in-school marketing. Any way that the NFL can reach kids, they are doing it. And all of these ways are reinforcing each other to kind of immerse kids in the brand.
In Phoenix, I asked NFL Vice President of Social Responsibility, Anna Isaacson, about that.
There's obviously a marketing aspect as well. I mean, you guys are interested in grooming the next generation of fans, right?
Yeah, I mean, listen, our role in social responsibility is to really make an impact on the community and to use the NFL for good and the platform that we have to give back.
My love of sports as a kid helped me learn about statistics and percentages, made me want to read the paper every morning to see how my teams did. And I probably saw a lot of ads because of that interest, too. But it also got me out of the house. My friends and I spent so much time pretending we were the pro athletes we loved, like Marcus Allen and Don Mattingly, catching the ball like they did, practicing, winning games like they did. I asked Josh Golan, if kids don't learn to love star players, will they be less inspired to simply play the game?
You know, if you're running around outside pretending to be, for me, it was Phil Sims or Lawrence Taylor, the NFL's not profiting off you at that moment. But the NFL is, you know, they don't necessarily want you to do that anymore. They want you buying their video games. They want you buying their merchandise. They want you to buy the products that their players are pitching.
But I'm not sure it's that simple. Without marketing, the big leagues might not get as many new young fans. And without kids hooked on the promise and excitement of professional and elite college sports, amateur and youth leagues might shrink. For a lot of us watching, playing and consuming sports are all intertwined. But it's worth thinking about the connections. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. Our intern is Joe Jacobs. We had help this week from Eilish O'Neill. Our senior producer is Gary Wallet. Our final word comes from boxer Daniel Jacobs, who loves old couples holding hands and soft skin.
If you met me, my hands are smooth, too. If you shook my hand, you wouldn't be like, really? Are you a boxer?
The first jab to the nose would probably answer that question. I'm Doug Tribou. Bill Littlefield will be back next week with more sports and PR style. Thanks for listening.